The months passed at a breathless pace, with constant reminders of all the things left undone. We worked with a citywide coalition in support of school reform. We held a series of joint meetings with Mexicans in the southeast side to craft a common environmental strategy for the region. I drove Johnny nuts, trying to cram him with the things that had taken me 3 years to learn. In February, I received my acceptance from Harvard Law School. The letter came with a thick packet of information. It reminded me of the packet I'd received from Punahou that summer 14 years earlier. I remembered how Gramps had stayed up the whole night, reading from the catalog about music lessons and advanced placement courses, glee clubs and baccalaureates, how he had waved the catalog and told me it would be my meal ticket, that the contacts I made at a school like Punahou would last me a lifetime, that I would move in charmed circles and have all the opportunities that he had never had. I remember how, at the end of the evening, he had smiled and tussled my hair, his breath smelling of whiskey, his eyes shining as if he were about to cry. And I had smiled back at him, pretending to understand, but actually wishing I was still in Indonesia, running barefoot along a paddy field, with my feet sinking in the cool, wet mud, part of a chain of other brown boys chasing after a tattered kite. I felt something like that now. I had scheduled a luncheon that week at our office for the 20 or so ministers whose churches had agreed to join the organization. Most of the ministers we'd invited showed up, as did most of our key leadership. Together we discussed strategies for the coming year. We set dates for a training retreat, agreed on a schedule of dues, talked about the continued need to recruit more churches. When we were finally finished, I announced that I'd be leaving in May and that Johnny would be taking over as director. That Sunday, I woke up at 6 a.m. I shaved, brushed the lint from my only suit, and arrived at the church by 7:30. Most of the pews were already filled. A white-gloved usher led me past elderly matrons in wide plumaged hats, tall, unsmiling men in suits and ties and mud-cloth kufis, children in their Sunday best. I shunted through to the center of a row and stuffed myself between a plump older woman who failed to scoot over and a young family of four, the father already sweating in his coarse woolen jacket, the mother telling the two young boys beside her to stop kicking each other. "Where's God?" I overheard the toddler ask his brother. "Shut up," the older boy replied. "Both of you settle down right now," the mother said. As the congregation joined in song, the deacons, then Reverend Wright, appeared beneath the large cross that hung from the rafters. The Reverend remained silent while devotions were read, scanning the faces in front of him, watching the collection basket pass from hand to hand. When the collection was over, he stepped up to the pulpit and read the names of those who had passed away that week, those who were ailing, each name causing a flutter somewhere in the crowd, the murmur of recognition. "Let us join hands," the Reverend said, "as we kneel and pray at the foot of an old rugged cross. Yes. Lord, we come first to thank you for what you've already done for us. We come to thank you most of all for Jesus. Lord, we come from different walks of life, some considered high and some low, but all on equal ground at the foot of this cross. Lord, thank you. For Jesus, Lord, our burden bearer and heavy load sharer, we thank you." The title of Reverend Wright's sermon that morning was The Audacity of Hope. He began with a passage from the book of Samuel, the story of Hannah, who, barren and taunted by her rivals, had wept and shaken in prayer before her God. The story reminded him, Reverend Wright said, of a sermon a fellow pastor had preached at a conference some years before, in which the pastor described going to a museum and being confronted by a painting titled Hope. "The painting depicts a harpist," Reverend Wright explained, "a woman who at first glance appears to be sitting atop a great mountain, until you take a closer look and see that the woman is bruised and bloodied, dressed in tattered rags, the harp reduced to a single frayed string. Your eye is then drawn down to the scene below, down to the valley below, where everywhere are the ravages of famine, the drumbeat of war, a world groaning under strife and deprivation. It is this world, a world where cruise ships throw away more food in a day than most residents of Port-au-Prince see in a year, where white folks' greed runs a world in need, apartheid in one hemisphere, apathy in another hemisphere. That's the world on which hope sits." And so it went, a meditation on a fallen world, While the boys next to me doodled on their church bulletin, Reverend Wright spoke of Sharpsville and Hiroshima, the callousness of policymakers in the White House and in the State House. As the sermon unfolded, though, the stories of strife became more prosaic, the pain more immediate. The Reverend spoke of the hardship that the congregation would face tomorrow, the pain of those far from the mountaintop, worrying about paying the light bill, but also the pain of those closer to the metaphorical summit, the middle-class woman who seems to have all her worldly needs taken care of, but whose husband is treating her like the maid, the house service, the jitney service, and the escort service all rolled into one. The child whose wealthy parents worry more about the texture of the hair on the outside of the head than the quality of the education inside the head. Isn't that the world that each of us stands on? Yes, sir. Like Hannah, we've known bitter times. Daily we face rejection and despair. Say it now. And yet consider once again the painting before us. Hope! Like Hannah, that harpist is looking upwards. A few faint notes floating upward toward the heavens. She dares to hope. She has the audacity to make music and praise God on the one string she has left. People began to shout, to rise from their seats and clap and cry out, a forceful wind carrying the Reverend's voice up into the rafters. As I watched and listened from my seat, I began to hear all the notes from the past 3 years swirl about me. The courage and fear of women like Ruby, the race pride and anger of men like Rafik, the desire to let go, the desire to escape, the desire to give oneself up to a God that could somehow put a floor on despair. And in that single note, hope, I heard something else. At the foot of that cross, inside the thousands of churches across the city, I imagined the stories of ordinary black people merging with the stories of David and Goliath, Moses and Pharaoh, the Christians in the lion's den, Ezekiel's field of dry bones. These stories of survival and freedom and hope became our story, my story. The blood that had spilled was our blood, the tears our tears, until this black church, on this bright day, seemed once more a vessel carrying the story of a people into future generations and into a larger world. Our trials and triumphs became at once unique and universal, black and more than black. In chronicling our journey, the stories and songs gave us a means to reclaim memories that we didn't need to feel ashamed about, memories more accessible than those of ancient Egypt, memories that all people might study and cherish, and with which we could start to rebuild. And if a part of me continued to feel that this Sunday communion sometimes simplified our condition, that it could sometimes disguise or suppress the very real conflicts among us, and would fulfill its promise only through action, I also felt, for the first time, how that spirit carried within it, nascent, incomplete, the possibility of moving beyond our narrow dreams. The audacity of hope! I still remember my grandmother singing in the house. There's a bright side somewhere. Don't rest till you find it. The audacity of hope! Times when we couldn't pay the bills. Times when it looked like I wasn't ever going to amount to anything. At the age of 15, busted for grand larceny auto theft, and yet and still my mama and daddy would break into a song. Thank you, Jesus, 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 thank you, Lord. And it made no sense to me, this singing. Why were they thanking him for all of their troubles, I'd ask myself. But see, I was only looking at the horizontal dimensions of their lives. I didn't understand that they were talking about the vertical dimension, about their relationship to God. I didn't understand that they were thanking him in advance for all that they dared to hope for in me. Oh, I thank you, Jesus, for not letting go of me when I let go of you. Oh, yes, Jesus, I thank you. And the choir lifted back up into song, and the congregation began to applaud those who were walking to the altar to accept Reverend Wright's call, and I felt a light touch on the top of my hand. I looked down to see the older of the two boys sitting beside me, his face slightly apprehensive as he handed me a pocket tissue. Beside him, his mother glanced at me with a faint smile before turning back toward the altar. It was only when I thanked the boy that I felt the tears running down my cheeks. "Oh, Jesus," I heard the older woman beside me whisper softly. "Thank you." for carrying us this far. Kenyatta International Airport was almost empty. Officials sipped at their morning tea as they checked over passports. In the baggage area, a creaky conveyor belt slowly disgorged luggage. Amo was nowhere in sight, so I took a seat on my carry-on bag and lit a cigarette. After a few minutes, a security guard with a wooden club started to walk toward me. I looked around for an ashtray, thinking I must be in a no-smoking area, but instead of scolding me, the guard smiled and asked if I had another cigarette to spare. "This is your first trip to Kenya, yes?" he asked as I gave him a light. "That's right." "I see." He squatted down beside me. "You are from America. You know my brother's son, perhaps, Samson Otieno. He is studying engineering in Texas." I told him that I'd never been to Texas, and so hadn't had the opportunity to meet his nephew. This seemed to disappoint him, and he took several puffs from his cigarette in quick succession. By this time, the last of the other passengers on my flight had left the terminal. I asked the guard if any more bags were coming. He shook his head doubtfully. "I don't think so," he said. "But if you will just wait here, I'll find someone who can help you." He disappeared around a narrow corridor, and I stood up to stretch my back. The rush of anticipation had drained away, and I smiled with the memory of the homecoming I had once imagined for myself. Clouds lifting, old demons fleeing, the earth trembling as ancestors rose up in celebration. Instead, I felt tired and abandoned. I was about to search for a telephone when the security guard reappeared with a strikingly beautiful woman, dark, slender, close to 6 feet tall, dressed in a British Airways uniform. She introduced herself as Miss Omoro and explained that my bag had probably been sent on to Johannesburg by mistake. "I'm awfully sorry about the inconvenience," she said. "If you'll just fill out this form, we can call Johannesburg and have it delivered to you as soon as the next flight comes in." I completed the form and Miss Omoro gave it the once-over before looking back at me. "You wouldn't be related to Dr. Obama by any chance?" she asked. "Well, yes, he was my father." Miss Omoro smiled sympathetically. "I'm very sorry about his passing. Your father was a close friend of my family's. He would often come to our house when I was a child." We began to talk about my visit, and she told me of her studies in London as well as her interest in traveling to the States. I found myself trying to prolong the conversation, encouraged less by Miss Omoro's beauty, she had mentioned a fiancé, than by the fact that she recognized my name. That had never happened before, I realized, not in Hawaii, not in Indonesia, not in L.A. or New York or Chicago. For the first time in my life, I felt the comfort, the firmness of identity that a name might provide, how it could carry an entire history in other people's memories, so that they might nod and say knowingly, "Oh, you're so-and-so's son." No one here in Kenya would ask how to spell my name or mangle it with an unfamiliar tongue. My name belonged, and so I belonged, drawn into a web of relationships, alliances, and grudges that I did not yet understand. "Parak!" I turned to see Alma jumping up and down behind another guard who wasn't letting her pass into the baggage area. I excused myself and rushed over to her, and we laughed and hugged as silly as the first time we'd met. A tall, brown-skinned woman was smiling beside us, and Alma turned and said, "Barak, this is our auntie Zaituni, our father's sister." "Welcome home," Zaituni said, kissing me on both cheeks. I told them about my bag and said there was someone here who had known the old man, but when I looked back to where I'd been standing, Miss Omoro was nowhere in sight. I asked the security guard where she had gone. He shrugged and said that she must have left for the day. Alma drove an old baby blue Volkswagen Beetle. The car was something of a business venture for her. Since Kenyan nationals living abroad could ship a car back to Kenya free of a hefty import tax, she had figured that she could use it during the year that she'd be teaching at the University of Nairobi and then sell it for the cost of shipping and perhaps a small profit. Unfortunately, the engine had come down with a tubercular knock, and the muffler had fallen off on the way to the airport. As we sputtered out onto the four-lane highway, Alma clutching the steering wheel with both hands, I couldn't keep from laughing. "Should I get out and push?" Zaituni frowned. "Hey, Betty, don't say anything about this car. This is a beautiful car. It just needs some new paint. In fact, Alma has already promised that I will have this car after she leaves." Alma shook her head. "Your aunt is trying to cheat me now, Barak. I promised we would talk about it, that is all." "What's there to talk about?" Zaituni said, winking at me. "I tell you, Alma, I will give you the best price." The two of them began to talk at the same time, asking how my trip had been, telling me all the plans they had made, listing all the people I had to see. Wide plains stretched out on either side of the road, savanna grass mostly, an occasional thorn tree against the horizon, a landscape that seemed at once ancient and raw. Gradually the traffic thickened, and crowds began to pour out of the countryside on their way to work, the men still buttoning their flimsy shirts, the women straight-backed, their heads wrapped in bright-colored scarves. Cars meandered across lanes and roundabouts, dodging potholes, bicycles, and pedestrians, while rickety jitneys, called matatus, I was told, stopped without any warning to cram on more passengers. It all seemed strangely familiar, as if I had been down the same road before. And then I remembered other mornings, in Indonesia, with my mother and Lolo talking in the front seat, the same smell of burning wood and diesel, the same stillness that lingered at the center of the morning rush, the same look on people's faces as they made their way into a new day, with few expectations other than making it through, and perhaps a mild hope that their luck would change, or at least hold out. We went to drop off Zaituni at Kenya Breweries, a large, drab complex where she worked as a computer programmer. Stepping out of the car, she leaned over again to kiss me on the cheek, then wagged her finger at Alma. "You take good care of Betty now," she said. "Make sure he doesn't get lost again." Once we were back on the highway, I asked Alma what Zaituni had meant about my getting lost. Alma shrugged. "It's a common expression here," she said. "Usually it means a person hasn't seen you in a while. You've been lost, they'll say. Or, don't get lost. Sometimes it has a more serious meaning. Let's say a son or husband moves to the city or to the west, like our Uncle Omar in Boston. They promise to return after completing school. They say they'll send for the family once they get settled. At first they write once a week, then it's just once a month. Then they stop writing completely. No one sees them again. They've been lost, you see, even if people know where they are." The Volkswagen struggled up an ascending road, shaded by thick groves of eucalyptus and liana vines. Elegant old homes receded behind the hedges and flower beds, homes that had once been exclusively British, Alma said, but that now mostly served government officials and foreign embassy staffs. At the top of the rise, we made a sharp right and parked at the end of a gravel driveway next to a yellow two-story apartment building that the university rented out to its faculty. A huge lawn sloped down from the apartment to meet patches of banana trees and high forest, and, further down, a narrow, murky stream that ran through a wide gully pitted with stones. Alma's apartment, a small, comfortable space with French doors that let sunlight wash through the rooms, was on the first floor. There were stacks of books everywhere, and a collage of photographs hanging on one wall, studio portraits and Polaroid shots, a patchwork of family that Alma had stitched together for herself. Above Alma's bed, I noticed a large poster of a black woman, her face tilted upward toward an unfolding blossom, the words, "I have a dream," printed below. "So what's your dream, Alma?" I said, setting down my bags. Alma laughed. "That's my biggest problem, Barak. Too many dreams. A woman with dreams always has problems." My exhaustion from the trip must have showed, because Alma suggested that I take a nap while she went to the university to teach her class. I dropped onto the cot she'd prepared and fell asleep to the buzz of insects outside the window. When I awoke, it was dusk, and Alma was still gone. From the kitchen, I noticed a troop of black-faced monkeys gathered beneath a banyan tree. The older ones sat warily at the tree's base, watching with knotted brows as pups scampered about through the long, winding roots. Rinsing my face in the sink, I put water on for tea, then opened the door that led into the yard. The monkeys all froze in their tracks, their eyes turned toward me in unison. A few feet away, the air filled with the beat of huge green wings, and I watched the dreamy ascent of a long-necked bird as it sent out a series of deep-throated cries and drifted towards distant canopies. The next morning, we walked into town and wandered without any particular destination in mind, just taking in the sights. The city center was smaller than I'd expected, with much of the colonial architecture still intact. Row after row of worn, whitewashed stucco from the days when Nairobi was little more than an outpost to service British railway construction. Alongside these buildings, another city emerged, a city of high-rise offices and elegant shops, hotels with lobbies that seemed barely distinguishable from their counterparts in Singapore or Atlanta. It was an intoxicating, elusive mixture, a contrast that seemed to repeat itself wherever we went, in front of the Mercedes-Benz dealership, where a train of Maasai women passed by on the way to market, their heads shaven clean, their slender bodies wrapped in red shukas, their earlobes elongated and ringed with bright beads, or at the entrance of an open-air mosque, where we watched a group of bank officers carefully remove their wingtip shoes and bathe their feet before joining farmers and ditch diggers in afternoon prayer. It was as if Nairobi's history refused to settle in orderly layers, as if what was then and what was now fell in constant noisy collision. That evening we drove east to Keriako, a sprawling apartment complex surrounded by dirt lots. The moon had dropped behind thick clouds, and light drizzle had begun to fall. At the top of three flights, Alma pushed against a door that was slightly ajar. Betty, you've finally come. A short, stocky woman with a cheerful brown face gave me a tight squeeze around the waist. Behind her were 15 or so people, all of them smiling and waving like a crowd at a parade. The short woman looked up at me and frowned. You don't remember me, do you? I'm your Aunt Jane. It's me that called you when your father died. She smiled and took me by the hand. Come, you must meet everybody here. Zaituni you have already met. This, she said, leading me to a handsome older woman in a green patterned dress. This is my sister Kazia. She's mother to Alma and to Roy Obama. Kazia took my hand and said my name together with a few words of Swahili. She says, her other son has finally come home, Jane said. My son, Kazia repeated in English, nodding and pulling me into a hug. My son has come home. We continued around the room, shaking hands with aunts, cousins, nephews, and nieces. Everyone greeted me with cheerful curiosity but very little awkwardness, as if meeting a relative for the first time was an everyday occurrence. I brought a bag of chocolates for the children, and they gathered around me with polite stares as the adults tried to explain who I was. I noticed a young man, 16 or 17, standing against the wall with a watchful expression. That's one of your brothers, Alma said to me. Bernard. I went over to the young man and we shook hands, studying each other's faces. I found myself at a loss for words, but managed to ask him how he had been. Fine, I guess, he answered softly, which brought a round of laughter from everyone. After the introductions were over, Jane pushed me towards a small table set with bowls of goat curry, fried fish, collards, and rice. As we ate, people asked me about everyone back in Hawaii, and I tried to describe my life in Chicago and my work as an organizer. They nodded politely but seemed a bit puzzled, so I mentioned that I'd be studying law at Harvard in the fall. Ah, this is good, Betty, Jane said as she sucked on a bone from the curry. Your father studied at this school, Harvard. You will make us all proud just like him. You see, Bernard, you must study hard like your brother. Bernard thinks he's going to be a football star, Zaituni said. I turned to Bernard. Is that right, Bernard? No, he said, uncomfortable that he had attracted attention. I used to play, that's all. Well, maybe we can play sometime. He shook his head. I like to play basketball now, he said earnestly. Like Magic Johnson. The meal smothered some of the initial excitement, and the children turned to a large black-and-white TV that was showing the munificence of the president. The president opens a school. The president denounces foreign journalists and various communist elements. The president encourages the nation to follow the path of Nyayo, footsteps towards progress. I went with Alma to see the rest of the apartment, which consisted of two bedrooms, both jammed from one end to the other with old mattresses. How many people live here? I asked. I'm not sure right now, Alma said. It always changes. Jane doesn't know how to say no to anybody, so any relative who moves to the city or loses a job ends up here. Sometimes they stay a long time, or they leave their children here. The old man and my mom left Bernard here a lot. Jane practically raised him. Can she afford it? Not really. She has a job as a telephone operator, which doesn't pay so much. She doesn't complain, though. She can't have her own children, so she looks after others. We returned to the living room, and I sank down into an old sofa. In the kitchen, Zaituni directed the younger woman in cleaning the dishes. A few of the children were now arguing about the chocolate I'd brought. I let my eyes wander over the scene, the well-worn furniture, the two-year-old calendar, the fading photographs, the blue ceramic cherubs that sat on linen doilies. It was just like the projects in Chicago, I realized. The same chain of mothers and daughters and children, the same noise of gossip and TV, the perpetual motion of cooking and cleaning and nursing hurts large and small, the same absence of men. We said our goodbyes around 10, promising to visit each and every relative in turn. As we walked to the door, Jane pulled us aside and lowered her voice. You need to take Betty to see your Aunt Sarah, she whispered to Alma, and then to me. Sarah is your father's older sister, the firstborn. She wants to see you very badly. Of course, I said, but why wasn't she here tonight? Does she live far away? Jane looked at Alma, and some unspoken thought passed between them. Come on, Barak, Alma said finally. I'll explain it to you in the car. The roads were empty and slick with rain. Jane is right, Barak, Alma told me as we passed the university. You should go see Sarah, but I won't go with you. Why not? It's this business with the old man's estate. Sarah is one of the people who has disputed the will. She's been telling people that Roy, Bernard, myself, that none of us are the old man's children. Alma sighed. I don't know. A part of me sympathizes with her. She's had a hard life. She never had the chances the old man had, you see, to study or go abroad. It made her very bitter. She thinks that somehow my mom, myself, that we are to blame for her situation. But how much could the old man's estate be worth? Not much, Alma said. Maybe a small government pension, a piece of worthless land. I try to stay out of it. Whatever is there has probably been spent on lawyers by now. But you see, everyone expected so much from the old man. He made them think that he had everything, even when he had nothing. So now, instead of getting on with their lives, they just wait and argue among themselves, thinking that the old man is somehow going to rescue them from his grave. Bernard has learned the same waiting attitude. You know, he is really smart, Barak, but he just sits around all day doing nothing. He dropped out of school, and he doesn't have much prospects for finding work. I've told him that I would help him get into some sort of trade school, whatever he wants, just so he's doing something, you know. He'll say okay, but when I ask if he's gotten any applications or talked to schoolmasters, nothing's been done. Sometimes I feel like unless I take every step with him, nothing will happen. Maybe I can help. Yeah, maybe you can talk to him, Alma said. But now that you're here, coming from America, you're part of the inheritance, you see. That's why Sarah wants to see you so much. She thinks I'm hiding you from her because you're the one with everything. The rain had started again as we parked the car. A single light bulb jutting from the side of the building sent webbed, liquid shadows across Alma's face. The whole thing gets me so tired, Barak, she said softly. You wouldn't believe how much I missed Kenya when I was in Germany. All I could do was think about getting back home. I thought how I never feel lonely here, and family is everywhere. Nobody sends their parents to an old people's home or leaves their children with strangers. Then I'm here, and everyone is asking me for help, and I feel like they're all just grabbing at me and that I'm going to sink. I feel guilty because I was luckier than them. I went to university. I can get a job. But what can I do, Barak? I'm only one person. I took Alma's hand and we remained in the car for several minutes, listening to the rain as it slackened. You asked me what my dream was, she said finally. Sometimes I have this dream that I will build a beautiful house on our grandfather's land. A big house where we can all stay and bring our families, you see. We could plant fruit trees like our grandfather, and our children would really know the land and speak Luo and learn our ways from the old people. It would belong to them. We can do all that, Alma, I said. She shook her head. Let me tell you what I start thinking then. I think of who will take care of the house if I'm not here. I think, who can I count on to make sure that a leak gets fixed or that the fence gets mended? It's terrible, selfish, I know. All I can do when I think this way is to get mad at the old man, because he didn't build this house for us. We are the children, Barak. Why do we have to take care of everyone? Everything is upside down, crazy. I had to take care of myself, just like Bernard. Now I'm used to living my own life, just like a German. Everything is organized. If something is broken, I fix it. If something goes wrong, it's my own fault. If I have it, I send money to the family, and they can do with it what they want, and I won't depend on them, and they won't depend on me. It sounds lonely, I said. Oh, I know, Barak. That is why I keep coming home. That is why I'm still dreaming. What is a family? Is it just a genetic chain, parents and offspring, people like me? Or is it a social construct, an economic unit, optimal for child-rearing and divisions of labor? Or is it something else entirely, a store of shared memories, say, an ambit of love, a reach across the void? I could list various possibilities, but I'd never arrived at a definite answer, aware early on that, given my circumstances, such an effort was bound to fail. Instead, I drew a series of circles around myself, with borders that shifted as time passed and faces changed, but that nevertheless offered the illusion of control. An inner circle where love was constant and claims unquestioned, then a second circle, a realm of negotiated love, commitments freely chosen, and then a circle of colleagues, acquaintances, the cheerful gray-haired lady who rang up my groceries back in Chicago, until the circle finally widened to embrace a nation or a race or a particular moral course, and the commitments were no longer tied to a face or a name, but were actually commitments I'd made to myself. In Africa, this astronomy of mine almost immediately collapsed, for family seemed to be everywhere, in stores, at the post office, on streets, and in parks, all of them fussing and fretting over Obama's long-lost son. If I mentioned in passing that I needed a notebook or shaving cream, I could count on one of my aunts to insist that she take me to some far-off corner of Nairobi to find the best bargains, no matter how long the trip took or how much it might inconvenience her. Ah, Betty, what's more important than helping my brother's son? If a cousin discovered, much to his distress, that Alma had left me to fend for myself, he might walk the 2 miles to Alma's apartment on the off chance that I was there and needed company. Ah, Betty, why didn't you call on me? Come, I will take you to meet some of my friends. And in the evenings, well, Alma and I simply surrendered ourselves to the endless invitations that came our way, from uncles, nephews, second cousins, or cousins once removed, all of whom demanded, at the risk of insult, that we sit down for a meal, no matter what time it happened to be or how many meals we had already eaten. Ah, Betty, we may not have much in Kenya, but so long as you are here, you will always have something to eat. At first, I reacted to all this attention like a child to its mother's bosom, full of simple, unquestioning gratitude. It conformed to my idea of Africa and Africans, an obvious contrast to the growing isolation of American life, a contrast I understood not in racial but in cultural terms, a measure of what we sacrificed for technology and mobility, but that here, as in the kampongs outside Jakarta, or in the country villages of Ireland or Greece, remained essentially intact. The insistent pleasure of other people's company, the joy of human warmth. As the days wore on, though, my joy became tempered with tension and doubt. Some of it had to do with what Alma had talked about that night in the car, an acute awareness of my relative good fortune, and the troublesome questions such good fortune implied. Not that our relatives were suffering exactly. Both Jane and Zaituni had steady jobs. Kazia made do selling cloth in the markets. If cash got too short, the children could be sent up country for a time. That's where another brother, Abo, was staying, I was told, with an uncle in Kendu Bay, where there were always chores to perform, food on the table, and a roof over one's head. Still, the situation in Nairobi was tough, and getting tougher. Clothes were mostly secondhand, a doctor's visit reserved for the direst emergency. Almost all the family's younger members were unemployed, including the two or three who had managed, against stiff competition, to graduate from one of Kenya's universities. If Jane or Zaituni ever fell ill, if their companies ever closed or laid them off, there was no government safety net. There was only family, next of kin, people burdened by similar hardship. Now I was family, I reminded myself. Now I had responsibilities. But what did that mean exactly? Back in the States, I'd been able to translate such feelings into politics, organizing, a certain self-denial. In Kenya, these strategies seemed hopelessly abstract, even self-indulgent. A commitment to black empowerment couldn't help find Bernard a job. A faith in participatory democracy couldn't buy Jane a new set of sheets. For the first time in my life, I found myself thinking deeply about money, my own lack of it, the pursuit of it, the crude but undeniable peace it could buy. A part of me wished I could live up to the image that my new relatives imagined for me, a corporate lawyer, an American businessman, my hand poised on the spigot, ready to rain down like manna the largesse of the Western world. But of course, I wasn't either of those things. Even in the States, wealth involved trade-offs for those who weren't born to it, the same sort of trade-offs that I could see Alma now making as she tried, in her own way, to fulfill the family's expectations. She was working two jobs that summer, teaching German classes to Kenyan businessmen, along with her job at the university. With the money she saved, she wanted not only to fix up Granny's house in Alego, but also to buy a bit of land around Nairobi, something that would appreciate in value, a base from which to build. She had plans, schedules, budgets, and deadlines. All the things she'd learned were required to negotiate a modern world. The problem was that her schedules also meant begging off from family affairs. Her budgets meant saying no to the constant requests for money that came her way. And when this happened, when she insisted on going home before Jane served dinner because things had started 2 hours late, or when she refused to let 8 people pile into her VW because it was designed for 4 and they would tear up the seats, the looks of unspoken hurt, barely distinguishable from resentment, would flash across the room. Her restlessness, her independence, her constant willingness to project into the future, all of this struck the family as unnatural somehow. Unnatural and un-African. It was the same dilemma posed to me the year I left Hawaii. The same tensions that certain children on the South Side might suffer if they took too much pleasure in doing their schoolwork. The same perverse survivor's guilt, that I could expect to experience if I ever did try to make money and had to pass the throngs of young black men on the corner as I made my way to a downtown office. Without power for the group, a group larger even than an extended family, our success always threatened to leave others behind. And perhaps it was that fact that left me so unsettled, the fact that even here, in Africa, the same maddening patterns still held sway, that no one here could tell me what my blood ties demanded, or how those demands could be reconciled with some larger idea of human association. It was as if we, Alma, Roy, Bernard, and I, were all making it up as we went along, as if the map that might have once measured the direction and force of our love, the code that would unlock our blessings, had been lost long ago, buried with the ancestors beneath a silent earth. Toward the end of my first week in Nairobi, Zaituni took me to visit our other aunt, Sarah. Alma had remained unwilling to go, but because it turned out that her mechanic lived near Sarah, she offered to give us a ride to her garage. From there, she said we could travel by foot. On Saturday morning, Alma and I picked up Zaituni and headed east, past cinderblock apartments and dry, garbage-strewn lots, until we finally came to the rim of a wide valley known as Matare. Alma pulled off to the shoulder, and I looked out the window to see the shanty town below. Miles and miles of corrugated rooftops shimmering under the sun like wet lily pads, buckling and dipping in an unbroken sequence across the valley floor. "How many people live there?" I asked. Alma shrugged and turned to our aunt. "What would you say, auntie? 500,000, maybe?" Zaituni shook her head. "That was last week. This week, it must be 1,000,000. Alma started the car back up. "Nobody knows for sure, Barak. The place is growing all the time. People come in from the countryside, looking for work, and end up staying permanently. For a while, the city council tried to tear down the settlements. They said it was a health hazard, an affront to Kenya's image, you see. Bulldozers came, and people lost what little they had. But of course, they had nowhere else to go. As soon as the bulldozers left, people rebuilt just like before." We came to a stop in front of a slanting tin shed where a mechanic and several apprentices emerged to look Alma's car over. Promising to be back in an hour, Zaituni and I left Alma at the garage and began our walk down a wide, unpaved road. It was already hot, the road bereft of shade. On either side were rows of small hovels, their walls a patchwork of wattle, mud, pieces of cardboard, and scavenged plywood. They were neat, though, the packed earth in front of each home cleanly swept, and everywhere we could see tailors and shoe repairers and furniture makers plying their trades out of roadside stalls, and women and children selling vegetables from wobbly wood tables. Eventually, we came to one edge of Matare, where a series of concrete buildings stood along a paved road. The buildings were 8, maybe 12 stories tall, and yet curiously unfinished, the wood beams and rough cement exposed to the elements like they'd suffered an aerial bombardment. We entered one of them, climbed a narrow flight of stairs, and emerged at the end of a long, unlit hallway, at the other end of which we saw a teenage girl hanging out close to dry on a small cement patio. Zaituni went to talk to the girl, who led us wordlessly to a low, scuffed door. We knocked, and a dark, middle-aged woman appeared, short but sturdily built, with hard, glassy eyes set in a wide, raw-boned face. She took my hand and said something in Luo. "She says she is ashamed to have her brother's son see her in such a miserable place," Zaituni translated. We were shown into a small room, 10 feet by 12, large enough to fit a bed, a dresser, 2 chairs, and a sewing machine. Zaituni and I each took one of the chairs, and the young woman who had shown us Sarah's room returned with 2 warm sodas. Sarah sat on the bed and leaned forward to study my face. Alma had said that Sarah knew some English, but she spoke mostly in Luo now. Even without the benefit of Zaituni's translation, I guessed that she wasn't happy. "She wants to know why you've taken so long to visit her," Zaituni explained. "She says that she is the eldest child of your grandfather, Hussein Onyango, and that you should have come to see her first." "Tell her I meant no disrespect," I said, looking at Sarah, but not sure what she understood. "Everything's been so busy since my arrival. It was hard to come sooner." Sarah's tone became sharp. "She says that the people you stay with must be telling you lies. Tell her that I've heard nothing said against her. Tell her that the dispute about the old man's estate has just made Alma uncomfortable about coming here." Sarah snorted after the translation and started up again, her voice rumbling against the close walls. When she finally stopped, Zaituni remained quiet. What'd she say, Zaituni? Zaituni's eyes stayed on Sarah as she answered my question. She says the child is not her fault. She says that it's Kazia's doing, Alma's mom. She says that the children who claim to be Obama's are not Obama's. She says that they have taken everything of his and left his true people living like beggars. Sarah nodded, and her eyes began to smolder. Yes, Betty, she said suddenly in English. It is me who looks after your father when he is a very small boy. My mother, Akumu, is also your father's mother. Akumu is your true grandmother, not this one you call Granny. Akumu, the woman who gave your father life, you should be helping her. And me, your brother's sister, look where I live. Why don't you help us instead of these others? Before I could answer, Zaituni and Sarah began to argue with each other in Luo. Eventually, Zaituni stood up and straightened her skirt. We should go now, Betty. I began to rise out of my chair, but Sarah took my hand in both of hers, her voice softening. Will you give me something for your grandmother? I reached for my wallet and felt the eyes of both aunts as I counted out the money I had on me, perhaps $30 worth of shillings. I pressed them into Sarah's dry, chapped hands, and she quickly slipped the money down the front of her blouse before clutching my hand again. Stay here, Betty, Sarah said. You must meet. You can come back later, Betty, Zaituni said. Let's go. Outside, a hazy yellow light bathed the road. My clothes hung limp against my body in the windless heat. Zaituni was quiet now, visibly upset. She was a proud woman, this aunt. The scene with Sarah must have embarrassed her. And then that $30, Lord knows she could have used it herself. We had walked for 10 minutes before I asked Zaituni what she and Sarah had been arguing about. Ah, it's nothing, Betty. This is what happens to old women who have no husbands. Zaituni tried to smile, but the tension creased the corners of her mouth. Come on, Auntie, tell me the truth. Zaituni shook her head. I don't know the truth, at least not all of it. I know that even growing up, Sarah was always closer to her real mom, Akumu. Barak, your dad, he cared only for my mom, Granny, the one who raised them after Akumu left. Why did Akumu leave? I'm not sure. You will have to ask Granny about that. Zaituni signaled for us to cross the street, then resumed talking. You know, your father and Sarah were actually very similar, even though they did not always get along. She was smart like him, and independent. She used to tell me, when we were children, that she wanted to get an education so that she would not have to depend on any man. That's why she ended up married to 4 different husbands. None of them lasted. The first one died, but the others she left because they were lazy or they tried to abuse her. I admire her for this. Most women in Kenya put up with anything. I did for a long time. But Sarah also paid a price for her independence. Zaituni wiped the sweat on her forehead with the back of her hand. Anyway, after Sarah's first husband died, she decided that your father should support her and her child, since he had received all the education. That's why she disliked Kazia and her children. She thought Kazia was just a pretty girl who wanted to take everything. You must understand, Betty. In Luo custom, the male child inherits everything. Sarah feared that once your grandfather died, everything would belong to Barak and his wives, and she would be left with nothing. I shook my head. That's no excuse for lying about who the old man's children are. You're right, but... But what? Zaituni stopped walking and turned to me. She said, after your father went off to live with his American wife, Ruth, well, he would go to Kazia sometimes. You must understand that traditionally she was still his wife. It was during such a visit that Kazia became pregnant with Abo, the brother you haven't met. The thing was, Kazia also lived with another man briefly during this time. So when she became pregnant again, with Banad, no one was sure who... Zaituni stopped, letting the thought finish itself. Does Bernard know about this? Yes, he knows by now. You understand, such things made no difference to your father. He would say that they are all his children. He drove this other man away and would give Kazia money for the children whenever he could. But once he died, there was nothing to prove that he had accepted them in this way. We turned a corner onto a busier road. In front of us, a pregnant goat bleated as it scuttered out of the path of an oncoming matatu. Across the way, 2 little girls in dusty red school uniforms, their round heads shaven almost clean, held hands and sang as they skipped across a gutter. An old woman with her head under a faded shawl motioned to us to look at her wares. Two margarine tins of dried beans, a neat stack of tomatoes, dried fish hanging from a wire like a chain of silver coins. I looked into the old woman's face, drawn beneath the shadows. Who was this woman, I wondered? My grandmother? A stranger? And what about Bernard? Should my feelings for him somehow be different now? I looked over at a bus stop, where a crowd of young men were streaming out into the road, all of them tall and black and slender, their bones pressing against their shirts. I suddenly imagined Bernard's face on all of them, multiplied across the landscape, across continents, hungry, striving, desperate men, all of them my brothers. Now you see what your father suffered. What? I rubbed my eyes and looked up to find my aunt staring at me. Yes, Betty, your father suffered, she repeated. I'm telling you, his problem was that his heart was too big. When he lived, he would just give to everybody who asked him. And they all asked. You know, he was one of the first in the whole district to study abroad. The people back home, they didn't even know anyone else who had ridden in an airplane before. So they expected everything from him. Ah, Barak, you're a big shot now. You should give me something. You should help me. Always these pressures from family. And he couldn't say no. He was so generous. You know, even me he had to take care of when I became pregnant. He was very disappointed in me. He had wanted me to go to college, but I would not listen to him and I went off with my husband. And despite this thing, when my husband became abusive and I had to leave, no money, no job, who do you think took me in? Yes, it was him. That's why, no matter what others sometimes say, I will always be grateful to him. We were approaching the garage shop. Up ahead, we could see Alma talking to her mechanic and hear the engine of the old VW whine. Beside us, a naked boy, maybe 3 years old, wandered out from behind a row of oil drums, his feet caked with what looked like tar. Again, Zaituni stopped, this time as if suddenly ill, and spat into the dust. When your father's luck changed, she said, these same people he had helped, they forgot him. They laughed at him. Even family refused to have him stay in their houses. Yes, Betty, refused. They would tell Barak it was too dangerous. I knew this hurt him, but he wouldn't pass blame. Your father never held a grudge. In fact, when he was rehabilitated and doing well again, I would find out he was giving help to these same people who had betrayed him. Ah, I could not understand this thing. I would tell him, Barak, you should only look after yourself and your children. These others, they have treated you badly. They are just too lazy to work for themselves. And you know what he would say to me? He would say, how do you know that man does not need this small thing more than me? My aunt turned away and, forcing a smile, waved to Alma. And as we began to walk forward, she added, I tell you this so you will know the pressures your father was under in this place, so you don't judge him too harshly. And you must learn from his life. If you have something, then everyone will want a piece of it. So you have to draw the line somewhere. If everyone is family, no one is family. Your father, he never understood this, I think. Alma and I received word that Roy had arrived, a week earlier than we'd expected. The family was thrilled by his arrival and had held off on a big feast only until Alma and I returned from safari. Bernard, who brought us the news, said that we were expected soon. He fidgeted as he spoke, as if every minute away from our eldest brother were a dereliction of duty. But Alma insisted on taking the time for a bath. Don't worry, she said to Bernard. Roy just likes to make everything seem so dramatic. Jane's apartment was in a hubbub when we arrived. In the kitchen, the women were cleaning collards and yams, chopping chicken, and stirring ugali. In the living room, younger children set the table or served sodas to the adults. And at the center of this rush sat Roy, his legs spread out in front of him, his arms flung along the back of the sofa, nodding with approval. He waved us over and offered us each a hug. Alma, who hadn't seen Roy since he moved to the States, stepped back to get a better look. You've become so fat, she said. Fat, eh? Roy laughed. A man needs a man-sized appetite. He turned towards the kitchen. Which reminds me, where's that other beer? No sooner had the words fallen from his mouth than Kazia came with a beer in hand, smiling happily. Betty, she said in English, this is the eldest son, head of the family. Another woman, who I'd never seen before, plump and heavy-breasted, with bright red lipstick, sidled up beside Roy and put her arm around him. Kazia's smile subsided, and she drifted back into the kitchen. Baby, the woman said to Roy, do you have the cigarettes? Yeah, hold on. Roy patted his shirt pockets carefully. Have you met my brother, Barak? Barak, this is Amy. You remember Alma? Roy found the cigarettes and lit one for Amy. Amy took a long drag and leaned forward toward Alma, exhaling round puffs of smoke as she spoke. Of course I remember Alma. How are you? Let me tell you, you look wonderful. And I like what you've done to your hair. Really, it's so natural. Amy reached for Roy's bottle, and Roy went to the dinner table. He grabbed himself a plate and bent down to smell the steaming pots. Chapos, he exclaimed, dropping three chapatis onto his plate. Sukuma wiki, he shouted the collard greens, before spooning a heap onto his plate. Ugali, he hollered, cutting off two big wedges of cornmeal cake. Bernard and the children followed his every step, repeating Roy's words at a more tentative volume. Around the table, our aunts and Kazia beamed with satisfaction. It was the happiest I'd seen any of them since my arrival. After dinner, while Amy helped the aunts wash up, Roy sat between Alma and me and announced that he had come back with big plans. He was going to start an import-export company, he said, selling Kenyan curios in the States. Chondos, fabrics, wood carvings, these things are big over there. You sell them at festivals, art shows, specialty stores. I already bought some samples to take back with me. That's a great idea, Alma said. Show me what you've got. Roy told Bernard to fetch several pink plastic bags from one of the bedrooms. Inside the bags were a few wood carvings, the sort of slick, mass-produced pieces that were sold at quick turnover to the tourists downtown. Alma turned them around in her hands with a doubtful expression on her face. How much did you pay for these?
Only 400 shillings each.
So much. Brother, I think you've been cheated. Bernard, why'd you let him pay so much? Bernard shrugged. Roy looked a bit wounded. I told you these are just samples, he said as he folded the carvings back in the wrapping. An investment, so I will know what the market wants. You can't make money unless you spend money, eh, Barak? That's what they say. Roy's enthusiasm quickly returned. You see, once I know the market, then I will send orders back to Zaituni. We'll build the business up slowly, you see. Slowly. Then, when we have a regular system, Bernard and Abo can go work for the company. Hey, Bernard, you can work for me. Bernard nodded vaguely. Alma studied her younger brother, then turned back to Roy. So what's the other big plan? Roy smiled.
Amy, he said. I'm going to marry her.
What? How long has it been since you last saw her?
2 years, 3 years, what does it matter?
You haven't had much time to think about it.
She's an African woman. I know that. She understands me, not like these European women always arguing with the men.
Roy nodded emphatically, and then, as if he were being yanked by an invisible string, he jumped out of his seat and headed towards the kitchen. Taking Amy in one arm, he lifted his bottle of beer towards the ceiling.
Listen, everybody. Now that we are here, we must have a toast. To those who are not with us, and to a happy ending.
With solemn deliberation, he started to pour his beer onto the floor. At least half of the beer splashed on Alma's shoes.
Ah!
Alma shouted, jumping back. What are you doing?
The ancestors must drink, Roy said cheerfully. It is the African way.
Alma grabbed a napkin to wipe the beer off her legs.
That's outdoors, Roy.
Not in somebody's house. I swear, sometimes you're so careless. Who will clean this up now? You? Roy was about to answer when Jane rushed up with a rag in her hand.
Don't worry, she said, wiping up the floor. We are just happy to have this one home.
It had been decided that after dinner we would all go out dancing at a nearby club. As Alma and I headed down the stairs ahead of the others, I heard her muttering to herself in the darkness.
Ugh, you Obama men, she said to me. You get away with anything. Have you noticed how they treat him? As far as they are concerned, he can do no wrong. Like this thing with Amy. This is just an idea that has popped into his head because he's lonely. I have nothing against Amy, but she is as irresponsible as he is. When they're together, they make each other worse. My mom, Jane, Zaituni, they all know this. But will they say anything to him? No. Because they're so afraid to offend him, even if it's for his own good.
Alma opened the car door and looked back at the rest of the family. They had just emerged from the shadows of the apartment building, Roy's figure towering over the others like a tree, his arms spread out like branches over the shoulders of his aunts. The sight of him softened Alma's face just a bit. At 5:30 in the evening, our train rumbled out of the old Nairobi station, heading west for Kisumu. Jane had decided to stay behind, but the rest of the family was on board. Kazia, Zaituni, and Alma in one compartment, Roy, Bernard, and myself in the next. "How long will it take to get to Home Square?" I asked. "All night to Kisumu," Alma said. "We'll take a bus or matatu from there. Another 5 hours, maybe." "By the way," Roy said to me, lighting a cigarette, "it's not Home Square. It's Home Squared." "What does that mean?" "It's something the kids in Nairobi used to say," Alma explained. "There's your ordinary house in Nairobi, and then there's your house in the country where your people come from. Your ancestral home. Even the biggest minister or businessman thinks this way. He may have a mansion in Nairobi and build only a small hut on his land in the country. He may go there only once or twice a year. But if you ask him where he's from, he will tell you that that hut is his true home. So when we were at school and wanted to tell somebody we were going to Alego, it was home twice over, you see. Home squared." Roy took a sip of his beer. "For you, Barak, we can call it home cubed." Alma smiled and leaned back in her seat, listening to the rhythm of the train on the tracks. "This train brings back so many memories. You remember, Roy, how much we used to look forward to going home? It's so beautiful, Barak. Not at all like Nairobi. And Granny, she's so much fun. Oh, you will like her, Barak. She has such a good sense of humor."
"She had to have a good sense of humor," Roy said, "living with the terror for so long."
"Who's the terror?" I asked.
Alma said, "That's what we used to call our grandfather, because he was so mean."
Roy shook his head and laughed.
"Wow, that guy was mean. He would make you sit at the table for dinner and serve the food on the china like an Englishman. If you said one wrong thing or used the wrong fork, pow, he would hit you with his stick. Sometimes when he hit you, you wouldn't even know why until the next day."
Zaituni waved them off, unimpressed.
"Ah, you children only knew him when he was old and weak. When he was younger, hey, I was his favorite, you know, his pet. But still, if I did something wrong, I would hide from him all day. I would be so scared. You know, he was strict even with his guests. If they came to his house, he would kill many chickens in their honor. But if they broke custom, like washing their hands before somebody who was older, he would have no hesitation in hitting them, even the adults."
"Doesn't sound like he was real popular," I said.
Zaituni shook her head. "Actually, he was well respected because he was such a good farmer. His compound in Alego was one of the biggest in the area. He had such a green thumb, he could make anything grow. He had studied these techniques from the British, you see, when he worked for them as a cook."
"I didn't know he was a cook."
"He had his lands, but for a long time he was cooking for Wazungu in Nairobi. He worked for some very important people. During the World War, he served as a captain in the British Army."
"Maybe that's what made him so mean."
"I don't know," Zaituni said. "I think my father was always that way. Very strict, but fair. I'll tell you one story I remember, from when I was only a young girl. One day, a man came to the edge of our compound with a goat on a leash. He wanted to pass through our land because he lived on the other side and he didn't want to walk around. So your grandfather told this man, 'When you are alone, you are always free to pass through my land. But today you cannot pass because your goat will eat my plants.' Well, this man would not listen. He argued for a long time with your grandfather, saying that he would be careful and that the goat would do no harm. This man talked so much, your grandfather finally called me over and said, 'Go bring me a Lego.' That's what he called his panga, you see."
"His machete, you mean?"
"Yes, his machete. He had two that he kept very, very sharp. He would rub them on a stone all day. One panga he called Alego. The other he called Kogelo. So I ran back to his hut and brought him the one he called Alego. And now your grandfather tells this man, 'See here, I have already told you that you should not pass, but you are too stubborn to listen. So now I will make a bargain with you. You can pass with your goat, but if even one leaf is harmed, if even one half of one leaf of my plants is harmed, then I will cut down your goat also.' Well, even though I was very young at the time, I knew this man must be so stupid because he accepted my father's offer. We began to walk, the man and his goat in front, me and the old man following closely behind.
We had walked maybe 20 steps when the goat stuck out its neck and started nibbling at a leaf. Then, whoosh! My dad cut one side of the goat's head clean through. The goat owner was shocked and started to cry out, "Ay, ay, what have you done now, Hussein Onyango?" And your grandfather just wiped off his panga and said, "If I say I will do something, I must do it. Otherwise, how will people know that my word is true?" Later, the owner of the goat tried to sue your grandfather before the council of elders. The elders all felt pity for the man, for the death of a goat was not such a small thing. But when they heard his story, they had to send him away. They knew that your grandfather was right because the man had been warned. Alma shook her head. "Can you imagine, Barak?" she said, looking at me. "I swear, sometimes I think that the problems in this family all started with him. He is the only person whose opinion I think the old man really worried about. The only person he feared." We all decided to turn in. The bunks were narrow, but the sheets were cool and inviting, and I stayed up late listening to the trembling rhythm of the train and the even breaths of my brothers, and thinking about the stories of our grandfather. It had all started with him, Alma had said. That sounded right somehow. If I could just piece together his story, I thought, then perhaps everything else might fall into place. I finally fell asleep and dreamed I was walking along a village road. Children dressed only in strings of beads played in front of the round huts, and several old men waved to me as I passed. But as I went farther along, I began to notice that people were looking behind me fearfully, rushing into their huts as I passed. I heard the growl of a leopard and started to run into the forest, tripping over roots and stumps and vines, until at last I couldn't run any longer and I fell to my knees in the middle of a bright clearing. Panting for breath, I turned around to see the day turn to night, and a giant figure looming as tall as the trees, wearing only a loincloth and a ghostly mask. The lifeless eyes bored into me, and I heard a thunderous voice saying only that it was time, and my entire body began to shake violently with the sound, as if I were breaking apart. I jerked up with a sweat, hitting my head against the wall lamp that stuck out above the bunk. In the darkness, my heart slowly evened itself, but I couldn't get back to sleep again. We arrived in Kisumu at daybreak and walked the half mile to the bus depot. It was crowded with buses and matatus honking and jockeying for space in the dusty open-air lot, their fenders painted with names like Love Bandit and Bush Baby. We found a sad-looking vehicle with balding, cracked tires that was heading our way. Alma boarded first, then stepped back out, looking morose. "There are no seats," she said. "Don't worry," Roy said as our bags were hoisted up by a series of hands to the roof of the bus. "This is Africa, Alma, not Europe." He turned and smiled down at the young man who was collecting fares. "You can find us some seats, eh, brother?" The man nodded. "No problem. This bus is first class." An hour later, Alma was sitting on my lap, along with a basket of yams and somebody else's baby girl. "I wonder what third class looks like," I said, wiping a strand of spittle off my hand. Alma pushed a strange elbow out of her face. "You won't be joking after we hit the first pothole." Fortunately, the highway was well paved, the landscape mostly dry bush and low hills, the occasional cinder block house soon replaced by mud huts with thatched conical roofs. We got off in Nori and spent the next 2 hours sipping on warm sodas and watching stray dogs snap at each other in the dust, until a matatu finally appeared to take us over the dirt road heading north. As we drove up the rocky incline, a few shoeless children waved but did not smile, and a herd of goats ran before us to drink at a narrow stream. Then the road widened and we finally stopped at a clearing. Two young men were sitting there, under the shade of a tree, and their faces broke into smiles as they saw us. Roy jumped out of the matatu to gather the two men into his arms. "Barak," Roy said happily, "these are our uncles. This is Yusuf," he said, pointing to the slightly built man with a mustache. "And this," he said, pointing to the larger, clean-shaven man, "this is our father's youngest brother, Said."
"Ah, we have heard many great things about this one," Said said, smiling at me. "Welcome, Betty, welcome. Come, let me have your bags."
We followed Yusuf and Said down a path running perpendicular to the main road, until we crossed a wall of tall hedges and entered a large compound. In the middle of the compound was a low, rectangular house, with a corrugated iron roof and concrete walls that had crumbled on one side, leaving their brown mud base exposed. Bougainvillea, red, pink, and yellow with flowers,
spread along one side in the direction of a large concrete water tank, and across the packed earth was a small round hut lined with earthenware pots, where a few chickens pecked in an alternating rhythm. I could see two more huts in the wide grass yard that stretched out behind the house. Beneath a tall mango tree, a pair of bony red cows looked up at us before returning to feed. Home squared.
Hey, Obama!
A big woman with a scarf on her head strode out of the main house, drying her hands on the side of her flowered skirt. She had a face like Saeed's, smooth and big-boned, with sparkling, laughing eyes. She hugged Alma and Roy as if she were going to wrestle them to the ground, then turned to me and grabbed my hand in a hearty handshake.
Hello,
she said, attempting English.
Musawa,
I said in Luo. She laughed, saying something to Alma. She says she has dreamed about this day, Alma translated, when she would finally meet this son of her son. She says you have brought her great happiness. She says that now you have finally come home. Granny nodded and pulled me into a hug before leading us into the house. Small windows let in little of the afternoon light, and the house was sparsely furnished. A few wooden chairs, a coffee table, a worn couch. On the walls were various family artifacts. The old man's Harvard diploma, photographs of him and of Omar, the uncle who had left for America 25 years ago and had never come back. Beside these were two older, yellowing photographs. The first of a tall young woman with smoldering eyes, a plump infant in her lap, a young girl standing beside her. The second of an older man in a high-backed chair. The man was dressed in a starched shirt and a kanga. His legs were crossed like an Englishman's, but across his lap was what appeared to be some sort of club, its heavy head wrapped in an animal skin. His high cheekbones and narrow eyes gave his face an oriental cast. Alma came up beside me. That's him. Our grandfather. The woman in the picture beside it is our other grandmother, Akumu. The girl is Sara. And the baby? That's the old man. I studied the pictures for some time, until I noticed one last picture on the wall. It was a vintage print, the kind that grace old Coca-Cola ads, of a white woman with thick dark hair and slightly dreamy eyes. I asked her what the print was doing here, and Alma turned to Granny, who answered in Luo. She says that is the picture of one of our grandfather's wives. He told people that he had married her in Burma when he was in the war. Roy laughed. She doesn't look very Burmese, eh, Barak? I shook my head. She looked like my mother. We sat down in the living room, and Granny made us some tea. She explained that things were well, although she had given away some of the land to relatives, since she and Yusuf could not work it all by themselves. She made up the lost income by selling lunches to the children at the nearby school, and bringing goods from Kisumu to the local market whenever she had some spare cash. Her only real problems were with the roof of the house. She pointed to a few threads of sunlight that ran from the ceiling to the floor, and the fact that she hadn't heard anything from her son Omar in over a year. She asked if I had seen him, and I had to say no. She grunted something in Luo, then started to gather up our cups. She says when you see him, you should tell him she wants nothing from him, Alma whispered. Only that he should come visit his mother. I looked at Granny, and for the first time since our arrival, her age showed on her face. After we unpacked our bags, Roy gestured for me to follow him into the backyard. At the edge of a neighboring cornfield, at the foot of a mango tree, I saw two long rectangles of cement, jutting out of the earth like a pair of exhumed coffins. There was a plaque on one of the graves. Hussein Onyango Obama. Born 1895, died 1979. The other was covered with yellow bathroom tiles, with a bare space on the headstone where the plaque should have been. Roy bent down and brushed away a train of ants that marched across the length of the grave. 6 years, Roy said. 6 years and there's still nothing to say who's buried here. I tell you now, Barak, when I die, you make sure that my name is on the grave. He shook his head slowly before heading back toward the house. How to explain the emotions of that day? I can summon each moment in my mind, almost frame by frame. I remember Alma and myself joining Granny at the afternoon market, the same clearing where the Matatu had first dropped us off, only now full of women who sat on straw mats, their smooth brown legs sticking straight out in front of them from under white skirts, the sound of their laughter as they watched me help Granny pick stems off collard greens that she'd brought from Kisumu, and the nutty sweet taste of a sugarcane stalk that one of the women put into my hand. I remember the rustle of the corn leaves, the concentration on my uncle's faces, the smell of our sweat as we mended a hole in the fence bounding the western line of the property. I remember how in the afternoon a young boy named Godfrey appeared in the compound, a boy who Alma explained was staying with Granny because his family lived in a village where there was no school. I remember Godfrey's frantic steps as he chased a big black rooster through the banana and papaya trees, the knot in his young brow as the bird kept flapping out of his reach, the look in his eyes when finally Granny grabbed the rooster from behind with one hand and unceremoniously drew her knife across the bird's neck, a look that I remembered as my own. It wasn't simple joy that I felt in each of these moments. Rather, it was a sense that everything I was doing, every touch and breath and word, carried the full weight of my life, that a circle was beginning to close, so that I might finally recognize myself as I was, here, now, in one place. Only once that afternoon would I feel that mood broken, when, on our way back from the market, Alma ran ahead to get her camera, leaving Granny and me alone in the middle of the road. After a long pause, Granny looked at me and smiled. "Hello," she said. "Musawa," I said. Our mutual vocabulary exhausted, we stared ruefully down at the dirt until Alma finally returned. And Granny then turned to Alma and said, in a tone I could understand, that it pained her not to be able to speak to the son of her son. "Tell her I'd like to learn Luo, but it's hard to find the time in the States," I said. "Tell her how busy I am." "She understands that," Alma said. "But she also says that a man can never be too busy to know his own people."